Deezer Originals.
Wherever you are, whenever you are, welcome to Talk Stew. My name is Reggie Yates, and I like to talk a lot. And sometimes I try and make sense, but usually I settle for sounding coherent as a solid win. Now, I'm in the fortunate position of being surrounded by friends who are equal parts articulate and fucking stupid. That's pretty apt, isn't it? Does that sound about right?
Speak for yourself.
Thank you. Now, the best conversations can sometimes be made up of the strangest ingredients, so please welcome to the gumbo two of my very good friends. Starting with this man to my right, Kevin McPherson, a.k.a. Clav. Kev, can you sort of explain Clav, as I'll be referring to you as both Kevin, idiot, shut up, mate, and Clav throughout the next...
I also respond to my lord and master.
Okay, that's a good start.
The nickname Mr. Clav came because I was famous at one point for covering Stevie Wonder's Superstitious.
Because you played the Clav like Stevie Wonder?
And people used to call me Mr. Clav, and then it got shortened to Clav.
I never knew that it was Stevie Wonder part of the story.
Every day's a school day.
Okay, good. Obviously, we go back, 15 years or something like that? So
longer than I care to remember.
How would you describe the way that we met and became friends for the people
so,
that don't know?
For those that don't know, I met this reprobate, to use your word.
Right, thank you.
when you were, I believe, in your late teens... Having
17, 18.
Yeah, having terrorized Ibiza.
It was actually Iron Apple, thank you.
Okay, I stand corrected. Yeah. I stand corrected.
Thank you.
And through a mutual friend of ours, we had been introduced. You were doing music, and our mutual friend had suggested that we get in the studio and work together with you and a couple of your friends.
Yeah.
And we just connected from there, and I think we've been friends ever since, and you've hung around me like a bad smell.
Completely.
What can I say?
How would you describe our friendship, Mr. McPherson?
Keep it clean.
genuine is a word that comes to mind. Intense at times.
Mm-hmm.
Always interesting.
Put this out there? We're not dating.
No, we're not dating.
You've just made it sound like we have a really passionate...
You asked the question that I think is important that we stress, yeah, that it's a strictly platonic...
But I would be a generous lover if we were in a relationship. And I think it's important that before we get into anything of any importance, the world needs to know where you're coming from.
I'm a believer in meritocracy and hard work.
That's a very good answer. Far more serious than I was expecting. Okay, facing me is Uzo. Uzo, I like to refer to as the Black Milk Tray Man. Apparently, Uzo is a photographer. Now, this is what he tells the world. Now, the only reason that I can begin to believe that you're a photographer is because you shot me once in a photo shoot that was horrible. It wasn't your fault. I was wearing clothes that were too tight.
Oh, Lord.
We were in...
That was my choice. You're lucky you were in clothes.
Thank you.
Wow.
Wow, we're like 3 minutes in. We were in the weirdest, most chintzy location. It was really strange. So the only reason I can believe that you're a photographer is because of that. But I'm convinced that you work for MI5. Because you're never here. You're always abroad. And you always wear black.
That's not true. Technically, this is grey. Keep it fresh.
Charcoal?
Okay, fair enough.
Charcoal?
technically, this is charcoal.
Gunmetal.
Technically, I'm wearing gunmetal. All right, now, I was thinking about this on the way down, because you know when you've known someone for a long time, it's quite difficult to actually work out how you met. I realised that in my phone, you're actually down as Uzo A-side.
That's hilarious. You're Reggie A-side.
Yeah. Okay, so we met through a mutual friend A-side, right?
Yes, yes.
How long ago was that? It's been a while,
I
right?
I can't call it. I'm doing sexy voice.
You are. You doing
are.
Sexy
you
voice.
Are. You I just slipped really straight are. Into it.
It's good. It's impressive. There's like lots of gaps, which says that you're thoughtful and also potentially very, very gentle.
I can't get, because I can hear myself.
You're still doing sex.
Because I can hear myself.
Is
this is the problem. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Take one can
Maybe
off.
Take one. Oh, that's better. There we go. Right.
Okay. Kevin said, what was it? Meritocracy and what else?
Hard work.
And hard work is what he deems as important and what he, how he sees the world. How about yourself?
I think that's a great question.
It's a tough one to boil down, but I think it gives the people listening that unfortunate one an insight into who you actually are.
Yeah, okay, so I see the world as a kinky stew of legs and orifices.
Wow.
In general.
Has that helped your career as a photographer?
Partially.
Right.
Yeah.
And has it hindered your time on the outside of jail?
Never going back, Rich. Never going back.
And my special guest, no offence, boys, is one of the leading... you should take offence, because he's definitely way more special than you.
Yeah, well.
He's one of the leading British names in broadcasting and reggae music, Mr. David Rodigan.
Can I get an ooh from the all the art crew.
Why have you just made your ooh sexy? Ugo?
It's David Rogan. So what question is that?
Talk stew. And that wonderful thing of Jamaicans and their language, because just saying that ooh and art chew and art stew and talk stew. It reminds me of this wonderful, wonderful moment many, many years ago. I was booked by Barney. Now, Barney's the top booker in New York.
Okay.
And he booked me to play at Atri.
Okay.
So I said, Atri? Yeah, man, Atri. It's one of the top clubs in Brooklyn, in Bronx. And I said, okay, well, I knew that was a big deal because I'd heard of this place. So we're driving there and I said to him, why is it called Hot Tree? You know, a tree, how can a tree be hot? And he looked at me and he said, we are chatbot. And as we arrived there on the billing, on the board, you know, right outside the club, Act 3 welcomes David Rodigan.
Legendary.
It was actually an Italian club owned by a guy called Nick.
No way.
Yeah. Well, and Nick had security around him, all of whom looked like they had Kellogg's cornflakes boxes shoved up inside their suits. These guys were serious Italians. Wow. And I was told, when Nick gives you the money, don't count it. Wow. And then this was Nick's speech. You guys don't play, and I'm not exaggerating, don't play any of your big dubs till at least 3 a.m. If you play the big dubs before then, I'm not going to sell any champagne. And this was Nick.
Wow.
This was a notorious, infamous club.
Amazing.
The whole thing was based on the hype surrounding that whole thing that we call Jamaica dance or clash culture, which is just so exciting. And it was,
guys, if you haven't realized, David Rodigan is in the room.
Heavy. Holla.
How mad is this? David Rodigan is here. Now, David, we sort of got into how I know these guys and where our relationships actually come from. And I think it's kind of fitting that we talk about how we met, because sure. I think it would be my birthday, wouldn't it? You DJed at my 30th birthday party.
Absolutely.
And
I thought it was your 20th, right?
Yeah, you're a generous man. Unfortunately, I'm a lot older than that. And this was a few years ago. So yeah, you played at my 30th birthday party, and my mum still talks about it to this day. In fact, I think she got a picture with you.
Yes, and, at the end, yeah, absolutely.
And it was incredible. So not only am I really glad that we made contact then and we stayed in touch, but you're here for this. So it's a real pleasure to have you here. My plan for the stew is to get into conversations that we as friends or people that work in the same business have privately on a public platform to share what causes some of the best arguments I've ever had over dinner with my friends or behind closed doors. So, well, I think the perfect place to start then, given our special guest, once again, no offence, is music. No, genuinely, I think it is. David, black British music is in an incredible place.
Isn't it? Isn't it?
To have someone like Stormzy, who is an underground artist, essentially was an underground artist, whatever that means these days, who's gone to number one with an independent album. He sold over 100,000 units. I mean, it's unheard of. Mm. As the older statesman in the room, particularly when it comes to music, David, what's your take on that?
For people who don't understand grime, it's not for you. I think this is one of the issues that surrounds modern music. Mm. In Jamaica, worldwide, when the older heads say, oh, I don't get that, I don't understand that, it wasn't made for them, it wasn't made for you, it was made for the people who support the artist. I think this is the key factor. Mm. Grime speaks for a new generation. Mm. It speaks to them directly, it speaks to them in a language they understand. It is unapologetic. It is what it is. And the energy which it generates, not only rhythmically, but lyrically, is what makes it so stimulating and so exciting. As a young person, 14, 15, 16, we can all remember those special years when we were discovering everything.
Yeah.
And we didn't want what mum and dad wanted. Mm. And when they said to us, "How? What are you playing that noise for?" It wasn't noise to us. It was music. It was noise to them. My dad was listening to the Glenn Miller Band, and I was listening to the Scatterlights. They were two different worlds, but there was something similar. They were both big bands. They were playing a different type of music. And that's why the whole grime thing has come through in such a powerful way. But we can sling it back 30 years. Those guys who worked on Saxon Sound as freestylers, they were speaking to a new generation. They weren't in Jamaica. They didn't live in Jamaica.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
They lived in London, in Birmingham.
They were toasting,
Manchester.
Right? They were toasting in a London accent.
Toasting.
Yeah.
And that spoke for a generation. And Saxon launched those people, and other sound systems did as well. And what we're seeing really is a rebirth of proud to be British, proud to be doing what we do. It's speaking to a generation. It's speaking for a generation. And that generation is listening and wants to be heard. That's why they're buying those records in bundles.
Yeah, Kevin, as a producer who produces both commercial music and music for film and television, what's your take on it? Because, you know, you're able to look at something like this from a very interesting perspective, because you've been a signed artist, but you also make music for signed artists now. So where do you stand on the way things have shifted?
Okay, before I answer that, I'm just going to follow on from one thing about Stormzy being a young man. He's so young, in fact, but he calls Reggie uncle. I think that is absolutely legendary.
Yeah, it's true.
But moving back to...
Cheers, Kev.
You're welcome. Don't mention it. My pleasure. So my take on it is music is communication. And as with anything in life, everything evolves, everything changes. The old gets replaced by the new. And although nothing is truly original, there is always a new take on something that we're familiar with. And so everything you've said, David, I absolutely agree with you. In fact, I think you probably said it more eloquently than I could. But I think my sort of take on grime and the energy of it, it's no different to punk. It's genre-wise may not be the same, but in terms of its energy and its in terms of its unashamedness, in terms of its directness and rawness. And it's a wonderful thing to see, because you think, well, you know, however old you are, at whatever stage in life you are, there was always going to be something that the previous generation turned up their noses to, which was precisely what the rebellious spirit of music is, the new music is.
Absolutely. Mm.
So I kind of feel, everything you've said, David, I agree with, in the sense that I feel like it's not necessarily music that speaks to me personally, but I appreciate it for what it is, because the same way when we were younger, we'd have been listening to, I don't know, it would have been LL Cool J, for example, or N.W.A., or, I don't know, Public Enemy, if you were so minded.
Sure.
Now it's the turn of these guys, and they have something to say, and they have their take on the world is different, because I don't know, maybe in our era we didn't have the internet, we didn't have social media, they do. So all these things that have changed and shaped and changed cultures now have to be addressed that would have not really been relevant at the time when we were coming up.
How about you, Uzo? Where do you stand on it?
On grime?
Well, not on grime, but just on where British black music is. I mean, we have a mutual friend who is a black British musician who has a Grammy Award, and she's done incredibly well.
Yes.
But she came along and found her success before this massive explosion.
Yeah,
the person I'm talking about is Estelle, someone we both know and love dearly.
Yeah.
Things have changed a lot really quickly. Why do you think that is?
I think both of what you were saying is the spirit and the energy of it, and what I love about British music is, and I feel funny about calling it black British music, but I think that's maybe something we should talk
Kevin,
about.
Kevin, can you hold up the sexy voice sign to Uzo, please? Because he's dropped an octave, and he's speaking in a sexy voice again. And you actually said British with a D. You said British.
British.
Okay, sorry. So
that was for the aunties.
Black, black British music with three Ds.
British. The thing is, I think we're going to get to the point where we've got Americans that want to sound like grime artists.
Well, we do. Drake.
No, he's not American. He's Canadian. Yes. He's Canadian. Okay. So you have to pause on that.
Okay, so why is that an interesting difference?
Because
we are talking about arguably the biggest musician in the world. One of the biggest artists right now. He's got billions of streams.
Yes, so, I agree. But
so he does want to sound like a British artist, I think.
He has a persona. And you have to be very careful with this, because I have lived in America for 5 years. I lived there.
In your face.
Hold up. And one thing I've realized of Americans, that for the most part, and we over here do not realize this until you've actually spent time amongst people who are brought up in hip-hop culture, for the most part, they're not trying to hear what we do. Mm. They're really not. Mm-hmm. It would be the same as the biggest German rapper, whoever that guy is, or French rapper.
He exists, we just don't know.
We don't know who he is. Coming here and us expecting to take him seriously.
Kevin, I'm going to interrupt you because I think what you're saying is so absolutely on point. I endorse everything you've just said.
Wow.
No, seriously, because that is the truth. I believe, and I use and the analogy of the German rapper coming here, equally, so important. There is a massive German rap scene, but no one in America... It is a very insular country in so many ways. And I mean this with all due respect. They are very concerned about what they're doing. Mm. And a tune could be massive in the Bronx and unknown in Fort Lauderdale.
Absolutely. Yeah, agree.
And they have these different different types and genres that sort of exist within their world. For instance, hyphy and was that Florida, I think it is, and bits of California. And then you've obviously got...
That's San Francisco. See?
Right. Here we go.
Chicago's got drill music, and you've all this different music that exists in very different areas.
You're bang on. The point I was going to get at is people get really excited when you see, you know, Skepta working with Drake or Stormzy, whoever. And it's great. It's great that they're being recognized. Mm. But the reason we are so familiar with American culture is because of the movies and the music. We understand their slang. Mm. We understand their lifestyle to some extent because it's so pervasive worldwide. It's not just here. It's everywhere. Mm. The difference between us and the Americans is when you go to America, Americans don't know about British culture.
That's really interesting that you say that because a lot of people have kicked off, particularly Black British Twitter, kicked off about the Drake record and the way in which Americans were reacting to gigs, for instance, on arguably the biggest song on the album. So there's loads of videos that have gone around where you see people dancing to, obviously doing it for comedy value, but they're dancing to the Drake verse, and the minute gigs comes in, they all stop and look around, look around confused.
The other thing we have to remember is, in terms of what hip-hop represents and its aspiration, it comes from a whole different place to grow. Mm. I'm not saying that the sentiment isn't the same, but I'm saying its history and what it stands for is in no way comparable. It just isn't.
But that's why this is an exciting time. Bringing the conversation full circle, I think it is a really exciting time because I think the reason that artists like Stormzy and Skepta are finding success both here in the UK and getting onto the radar of arguably the biggest MC in the world in Drake is that they are unapologetically British. Unapologetically who they are, which is why I think that that authenticity is resonating with audiences around the world.
That's what I think is going to happen.
Go on.
That's what I feel like, because after a while, you know, if you're a rapper and you sold drugs on the streets and then you got in the booth and then you got on and you're in the game, after a while it's just like, this is nothing new. Mm. This is nothing special. Your story is exactly the same as everybody else's, and most of the people are fabricating their stories. So I feel like when you see stuff that is so real and so honest and so true, I think that it's going to hit people around the world. I think because they're going to finally go, oh, wow, I can feel this. I can feel this. Because, you know, if you do anything too much, you get used to it. Yeah. You know, and I'm desensitized to rappers in general. No disrespect, but I'm desensitized. I'm like, oh, yeah, look, you're acting like a thug.
Do you still do you think you're a rap fan now?
I think I'm a hip-hop fan.
Big difference.
Yeah, sure.
What's been the shift? Is it the way that the music has gone, or is it just getting older? Because, you know, none of us in this room are kids.
It's definitely getting older, but it isn't developing, you know? I think progress and development are very different things, and I think development comes from within, you know? And I think that you can progress, you can make more money, more people can know about you, but you're not developing, you know? Like, who's breaking ground?
The authenticity conversation and breaking ground from the British Black music perspective brings me to a place that I'm fascinated by, and that is identity, particularly when it comes to something like music. And David, you're the perfect person to speak to about this because you are not only an older statesman of Black British music and reggae specifically, but you're also a white man. So in terms of identity and in terms of establishing yourself in that world when you began, how were you able to do that, and what sort of challenges did you face, and how accepting was the world of reggae music to you?
What actually happened at the beginning was no one knew I was white and they thought I was black because I was on radio, and my first audition was at BBC Radio London, which they stopped after 10 minutes and said, thank you, Mr. Rodigan, you clearly know a lot about this music, but we're looking for a black presenter. And I said, fine, and I left the audition. And a few weeks later, they sent me a letter saying, please return, we'd like to offer you a show with Tony Williams and a couple of other presenters. Because what they did is they played my audition tape to black record producers and people in the reggae industry, black people. And they asked them their opinion. And I was told that all of them said, whoever that guy is, you should use him. But they didn't know I was white.
Wow.
So I was on air for a good year before I did a public appearance. In fact, it was more like 18 months.
No.
And my first public appearance was at the Apollo Club in Wilsden.
Let's set the scene here. What year are we talking about?
Okay, 1978, September, I get the show. I'm on air on BBC Radio London every Sunday lunchtime, co-hosting and then alternating with Tony Williams. And because I talked about the music, because I cared about the music, because I knew about the music, listeners believed. You can ask Ian Wright, you can ask all of them. I mean, they were kids then. They presumed that this man was a black man.
And if you know London, you will know that Northwest London to this day still has a huge West Indian community.
Correct.
So for you to be playing in Wilsden in the 70s.
Yes. So
I presume the crowd was full of cocoa bar.
It was completely black, right? And the MC brought me onto the stage and he said, before he brought me on, he said, ladies and gentlemen, I'll never forget this night as long as I live. For the first time, the man you've been hearing on radio is playing his first dance in London. Please welcome on stage David Rodigan. And this tremendous roar went up, cheers and cheers. And I walked out onto the stage and a deafening hush descended across the Apollo Club in Wilsden, right? And you saw hundreds of black people going, a white man. And the MC said to me, you better say something quick and play a tune even quicker. So I said, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And as I started to speak, I swear to God, I saw people in the front row closing their eyes.
Wow.
Because they were listening to the voice. And then I signed on with Stavanana. And it was the Roots Rockers Saturday Night Capital Radio intro, which I'd cut onto an acetate. The place erupted, and I played my first tune. And that was the night. It was a baptism of fire for me.
The thing is, I think your love is undeniable, and so are your credentials. You know, nobody can question your authenticity, and the same thing can be said about someone like a Tim Westwood, arguably a newer generation iteration would be someone like a Charlie Slough.
Yes,
I'm interested to find out what your take on those guys actually is, because you know you were around a long time before both of them. So, without putting too much pressure on you, and without putting you in an uncomfortable position, how would you describe your take on them and their relationship with identity and with black music?
They're both passionate about what they do. No one could deny that. Some would say that perhaps the way in which they talk about it and the way in which they present their radio shows is pretty up there and dynamic. It's not my style of broadcasting, but no two people are the same. And it would be a boring world if we were all presenting in the same way. What they both do is present with passion, and they both have deep knowledge, and that shines through. And as is the case in anything in life, whether it's jazz, whatever form of culture is art, there are going to be people who get off on that, who love that style of presentation, and then there are going to be others that don't. But the key factor here has to be, do they actually know what they're talking about?
Right.
And I think it is more than apparent that both those presenters know exactly what they're talking about, and both of them have big fan bases.
Huge.
Tim Westwood would not be broadcasting for all those years, decades, had he not developed a fan base. And he did. I mean, I remember Tim Westwood when, and I've told this story before, he was a glass collector in a club that I worked in Dean Street called Gossips in Soho. It was the first black club in Soho owned by a black man called Vince Howard. You had the Q Club in Paddington, but in Soho, that was the spot. And Tim Westwood was a glass collector. And me and Papa Face remember quite clearly that this young man pestered us and said, please, 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 can you give me the opportunity to be the warm-up DJ? And in the end, it was his unabiding enthusiasm that we couldn't resist. So we said, okay. And do you know what he did? He promoted himself on the street with flyers and handbills, saying what he was doing and where he was doing it. And he brought people into that club. He may have played the music a little bit too loud and blown the speakers one night and got told never to come back by the management, but that's another story. The fact of the matter is, and what we couldn't deny, was his unbelievable passion for the music. And he eventually went on LWR Radio, had his own show there, and then, of course,
Kiss FM.
Yeah, and then he landed the show on Capital Radio, and then he went from Capital Radio, where he was very popular, to Radio 1. So his journey has been a journey based on knowledge and passion. Mm. And there are two Tim Westwoods, you know. There are two. There's the persona on air, and there's a very different persona that I know. Because I remember him when he was that glass collector, and I remember him when I used to share airtime with him, either before or after when we were on air together at Capital Radio. And I remember when I was in hospital, it was Tim Westwood who came to visit me. Mm-hmm. Right. So there was somebody who... I used to say to him, Tim, you're talking to me. Mm. And okay. And so he that persona of the hip-hop with the speech and the down with it.
Glasses.
There's another side. Witty, observant, knowledgeable. Mm. And I would say, I don't know Charlie Sloth as well, but I would say that in my encounters with Charlie Sloth, that there are probably two Charlie Sloths. Yeah. There's an on-air persona that they want to present because they enjoy that. And there's an element of show business in all of this. Mm-hmm. When you go on stage and when you go into a radio station and you're presenting a show, you are a different person to the person perhaps at home reading the newspaper, having a conversation with your partner.
I have a question. Your persona seems exactly the same.
Yes.
And is that a conscious thing?
Yes, yeah, because I can't be very... I'm glad you brought that up. I can't be what somebody else... I mean, I've trained as an actor, so I know you can have a character, but there's no script for this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I was taught... When I first got my training at the BBC, I was taught, you have to find yourself on air. Mm. Don't try and be a DJ, which because it won't come through. Just be yourself. Remember, you're someone's companion. You've been invited into their car, their front room, their bathroom. Just talk to them. You don't have to hammer them. Mm. You don't have to hype them. So that's the training I was given. And I couldn't pretend to be Jamaican. Mm. I couldn't pretend to speak with a Jamaican accent.
From identity to my last topic, which is film. Arnie or Iron Man? You know, what was the better era?
The more pertinent question is CGI or real-life actors.
Very, very true.
No, but I mean, David, for someone like yourself, you know, I was a kid watching these movies repeated on television. Mm. You were of the age to take your girlfriend to the theatre on a date. Yeah. To see an the new Arnie movie, and they were events.
No, not the new Arnie movie. Believe me, when I was dating, there was no Arnie. Trust me.
But like, you know, when
an antique.
When Die Hard was what it was, when it was its most exciting.
Even then, I wasn't taking dates.
I'm trying to help you out, Dave.
No, it's okay. I'm actually building a defense here so that I don't fall down into a big hole and say that, to use the old Jamaican expression. But seriously, going to the movies is at times is, I mean, I agree, the whole franchise thing, it's just overpowering. Mm. And I'm going to sound like a real antique here when I tell you that I think they're all way too loud. The kind of overall experience sometimes is truly deafening. But I don't think I've really answered the question. I'm sort of juggling around it. What was the question?
What era was better, really?
I mean, I have memories of a very different period in cinema where, I remember seeing Mutiny on the Bounty, thinking that was absolutely amazing with Marlon Brando. Mm. And I was in awe of it. Mm. That was in the, 62 or something. But I think that there are periods in time and there are feelings, the third man, Orson Welles.
Yeah.
You know, how much of this food? And then the first thing you see is his feet in a doorway, his shoes. You know, was that special? Yeah, it was really special. Does it stand the test of time? Yes, it does. I'm going to say that I will always be enamored by a period in time that I found fascinating because I was discovering these things for myself as somebody went to the movies.
Mm-hmm. How about yourself, Uz? Where do you stand on those two eras?
Oh, if I had to say, I would say everything that came before, but not even when I grew up. I would even say
prior.
Before, I would say before then. I think the first thing I ever saw at the cinema was E.T.,
Right.
Yes. Oh, wow. Yeah.
Game changer.
Yeah. Wow.
Because it started with something that is, to this day, is still one of the greatest films I think that have ever been made.
Mm.
And so, but I think that, again, what we've been talking about is the people, accountants run the film industry.
Yeah. Mm.
So, you know, there's a director that have great ideas that would be nailing it. But, you know, yeah, but it's not for everybody, you know. So why can't we make it, you know, 3D or something like, you know. And these things, I think they ruin films. One thing I would say is that what they're doing now is almost appropriate, not necessarily for us, but for the kids that are, everything is sensational.
Mm.
Everything. So even the way they cut it, if you notice, they cut.
Oh, my God.
Every half a second,
yeah.
they're cutting it, because they have to keep people awake. You know, instead of watching a long take and a beautiful, do you know what I mean, and getting the feet, people cut.
Don't get me on that subject. Yeah, yes, I can talk all day on that. This videos, split second, blink of an eye.
This is it. So you feel, it's all about sensationalism. So I feel like some of that's lost. But then there's directors like Christopher Nolan. Big up Christopher Nolan.
Holla.
Right? Because what he does, he's an old school filmmaker that makes, in my opinion, big budget.
Art house
films.
Yeah,
you know,
Dunkirk looks like an art house movie. There you go. That's his next picture,
and that I think is combining, you know, what we have in our history and trying to update. I think is always a good way to go.
And on the flip side, you've got someone like Steve McQueen who brings art to the cinema screen and does incredible things with it.
Big up Steve McQueen.
But I'm really annoyed. I've started speaking about film now, and we've got to close it up.
Oh well,
we've got to end it there. Listen, this has been Talk Stew, and. Thank you so much to my guests around the table. First and foremost, Mr. McPherson. Clav, thank you very much for joining. Uzo, a.k.a. the Black Milk Tray Man, a.k.a. Mr. Sexy Voice.
A.k.a. Black James Bond.
A.k.a. the Black James Bond wearing gunmetal grey. As a standard. Thank you for joining us. And, of course, our special guest, no offence, David Rodigan. Thank you for joining the table.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining the Stew. This has been Talk Stew, and we will see you next time. Talk Stew is a Pixu the 5-7 Deezer production. For bonus content, download the Deezer app or go to Deezer.com.
Deezer. Originals.